Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, the Greek community in Tarpon Springs holds a unique Epiphany celebration every January 6th.
We will go on to the platform where His Eminence will do a short service and throw the cross into the bayou, and the divers will then attempt to retrieve. The young man who retrieves the cross receives the blessing for the year.
We'll talk about Florida in the French Revolution.
The alliance between the ideals of revolutionary France and indigenous settler republicanism remained constant and fueled a critique of the American power structure. And Florida continued to play a central role in borderland disputes until its addition to the United States in 1819.
And Bob Keeling will discuss the new edition of his book, Kerouac in Florida, Where the Road Ends. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Every year, thousands of people go to Tarpon Springs on January 6th to watch the unique Epiphany celebration that is held there. The tradition comes from the town's Greek Orthodox Church, and there are more Greeks per capita in Tarpon Springs than in any other American city. Greek sponge divers and their families first moved to the pioneer town of Tarpon Springs in 1905 to participate in the area's growing sponge industry. Father James Roussakis is from St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church in Tarpon Springs.
Thanks to the sponge divers, we have this parish here. It wasn't a cathedral then. It didn't become a cathedral till later. But one of the things that they began right away, being a nautical people, was to have the traditional dive for the cross.
St. Nicholas has evolved over time. The Neo-Byzantine-style cathedral was expanded in 1943 to include colorful stained glass and marble from Greece in a domed basilica.
This was very typical of the churches that were built in America during the 40s, early 50s. In fact, I'm originally from the Detroit area, and there was a parish that I attended in Detroit, and if I walked in to that parish or that church building, and I walk into this, I'm like the same place. It's very typical of that, of the structures during that time period. As I said, basilica with a dome.
The Greek Orthodox Church can trace its roots back to the earliest church established during the Roman Empire. At its height, the empire encompassed the entire Mediterranean basin, including what are now Europe, Turkey, the Middle East, and North Africa. When the empire collapsed in the year 476, Christian centers in the East and West gradually began developing separate traditions.
Up to the year 1054, there was only one church. We name that church, as we say in our creed, the one holy Catholic, Catholic with a small c, meaning universal, and apostolic church. There was one church, it was a holy church, it was universal church, and it was founded from, and it was came from the apostles. So there was just one church that existed. There were five centers of Christianity at that time. Four of them were in the east, being Constantinople, Antioch, Jerusalem, Alexandria, and only one in the west, and of course that was Rome. Well, given the geographics of the two areas, and there were no jet planes at that time to take you from one place to the other, sometimes rulings that happened, especially at the ecumenical synods that occurred all in the east, it took a while to get to the west. And so each area started to develop in a different way. The east centers being closer together were more unified. The west wasn't as unified. And so finally in 1054, the church severed. The west became known as the Roman Catholic Church, and the east became known as the Eastern or Greek Orthodox Church.
In the Greek Orthodox tradition, Epiphany is the commemoration of the baptism of Jesus in the Jordan River when the Holy Spirit appeared to him as a dove.
Traditionally, it's celebrated in the church, and it has to do now with the blessing of the waters. And that's very important for a sea-going community, as Tarpon Springs is and was.
Folklorist Tina Bukovalis lives in Tarpon Springs and documents the culture there.
Because there was a traditional belief that between Christmas and Epiphany, the waters were not hallowed, and the blessing of the waters was necessary so that mariners could go out and safely conduct their business again on the ocean.
Tasso Karastinos is a traditional sponge diver in Tarpon Springs.
This traditional for Epiphany Day goes on since 1905. And keep going, and every year it gets better and better, and more people, and the Greeks from all over the United States, they come here special for this day, to celebrate Epiphany. And the Greek language is Theophania. Theophania means the God showing and seeing it. And comes out, the Spirit comes as the white dove when they baptize the Jesus. That's what Theophania in the Greek language means. Now over here they call them Epiphany.
In Tarpon Springs, the Epiphany celebration begins on January 5th with the blessing of the boats at the sponge docks downtown. The more formal commemoration takes place the next day at St. Nicholas Cathedral.
Well, we, of course, begin in the morning with our regular service, the Matins, followed by the Divine Liturgy, which is comparable to the Mass in the Roman Church. Then there is the greater blessing of water here in the cathedral. After that is done, we have a procession that we will go down to the bayou, and there His Eminence, the Archbishop, will bless the young divers. They are boys the ages of 16 through 18, and then the boys will make their way into the water and onto the small boats, the dinghies that are there, and we will go on to the platform where His Eminence will do a short service and throw the cross into the bayou, and the divers will then attempt to retrieve. The young man who retrieves the cross receives the blessing for the year.
Father James Roussakis is with St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church in Tarpon Springs. We also spoke with folklorist Tina Bukovalis and traditional sponge diver Tasso Karastinos. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers. Find out about upcoming events and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, as the French Revolution got underway, the United States faced one of its early diplomatic crises. France had supported the American Revolution with funding, ships, and military expertise. French revolutionaries now anticipated at least ideological support from the young republic, but the presence of the Spanish in Louisiana and Florida and internal unrest among the southern states that questioned what was perceived as a consolidation of wealth and power at the national level of government complicated the American position toward France.
In his summer 2009 article, Entangled Borderlands, Robert J. Alderson, Jr. lays out the issue in his first sentence, quote, "In 1793-1794, a motley group of South Carolina and Georgia backcountry men entered into a conspiracy with French revolutionaries to invade Spanish territories in Louisiana and Florida, end quote. Although the plot collapsed before the planned invasion occurred, the events are representative of the entanglement of ideology and self-interest on the borderlands of the early republic. Seminal works on the early republic by historians Bernard Balin, Allison Gaimes, and Ian Steele focused on the Atlantic flow of commodities, the destruction and emergence of empires, the movement of people and ideas, and the evolution of new cultural forms to understand the events of the period. More recently, Michael Morris placed the planned invasion of East Florida within the context of Bertram Wyatt Brown's analysis of Southern honor and violence. Alderson returns to the expanded framework of regional and global actions to argue that, quote, Florida's importance in the scramble for land and position in a world transformed by revolution became evident. The projected invasion of East Florida blurred national boundaries in that American adventurers were to invade Spanish territory and attack British and Spanish shipping under the French flag. Moreover, the Americans who took part in the planning of the invasion were dissidents in their demands for political power, land, and in their view, a say in what it meant to be a republic. This entangled history on the periphery of the Atlantic communities moved in directions and speeds that policymakers at the core could not always manage. The Florida expedition is an example, Alderson asserts, of the interplay between the local and geopolitical, and places Florida at the center of the Atlantic world. Finally, Alderson claims that the American revolutionary ideals traveled to France and combined with European ideology to foster the French Revolution before being transmitted back to America. This much-traveled ideology informed self-interest to justify the invasion as not a mere land grab, but as the spread of revolutionary republicanism.
Connie, listeners are likely more familiar with these events than they may realize. Every American History Survey course makes some reference to Edmond Charles Genet, the French representative of the revolutionary Girondin faction who came to the United States in 1792. Like his fellow revolutionaries, he believed Americans would aid the French in their war with European monarchs and assist in the export of revolution ideology to British and French colonies.
Yes, Citizen Genet was tasked with maintaining good relations with the U.S. government while simultaneously arming privateers in American ports and raising troops to invade Canada, Louisiana, and Florida. Landing in Charleston, South Carolina in September 1792, he quickly connected with Michel Ange Bernard Mangery, the local French consul, and important Americans, including South Carolina Governor Moultrie. He was met with enthusiasm by the South Carolina citizenry and encountered the same warm welcome as he made his way to Philadelphia in the spring of 1793. The Washington administration was not amused by his recruiting efforts and issued a proclamation of neutrality on April 22, 1793. Genet was not deterred and informed Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson of his intent to continue his appeal to the American people for funds, troops, and ideological support for the French cause, actions that violated the American position of neutrality. In a series of provocative actions, Genet met with George Rogers Clark, the Revolutionary War hero, who offered to raise forces in Kentucky, outfitted a privateer in Philadelphia, and attempted to take control over a mutinous French fleet that arrived in New York Harbor. The Washington administration requested that the French government, now under the control of the Jacobins, recall Genet. Fearing for his safety if he returned to France, Genet requested and received American asylum. He subsequently married the daughter of the governor of New York and settled into the life of a gentleman. Most American history surveys end the story of Citizen Genet there. But Consul Mangery, while remaining in touch with Genet, continued his activities toward the invasions of Louisiana and Florida. Mascherie insisted that the majority of ordinary Southerners, small farmers, backcountrymen, and Revolutionary War veterans were discontented with the actions of the Washington administration in consolidating power at the expense of the people. An important cohort of influential Southerners also joined the group of men surrounding Mascherie, including the governors of South Carolina and Georgia, William Tate, a member of the South Carolina Yazoo Company, a land speculation group interested in opening land to the Mississippi River, a former officer under Casimir Pulaski, and Stephen Drayton, a wealthy South Carolina planter. Mascherie organized a political club, the Republican Society of South Carolina, with 109 members. Drayton served as president of the organization, and Tate was secretary. Tate was also commissioned as a colonel in the Revolutionary Legion of America and developed plans for the invasion of Louisiana. Leaders of the Florida invasion were Major Claudius Best and Colonel Samuel Hammond. Hammond and his brother Abner were partners in the Indian trading firm Hammond and Fowler. They hoped the invasion of Florida would depose the dominant trading house, Panton, Leslie, and Company, although on record as an opponent of the centralizing efforts of Alexander Hamilton. It is difficult to determine if Hammond acted as a patriot or a profiteer in his actions against Florida. Mascherie did not find the two positions mutually exclusive and claimed that self-interest and Republican ideals were compatible.
Connie, it would seem that the revolutionary Republicans were well-organized and ready to carry out a successful invasion. What happened?
The would-be invaders faced a number of pressing problems, namely a lack of funds and a lack of naval support. Added to that, the South Carolina legislature launched an investigation of the revolutionary organization. The governors of South Carolina and Georgia issued bans on recruitment by the group, and the Spanish governor of Florida became aware of the impending invasion and took steps to protect his border. Declaring, "We are in peace but prepared for war," he ordered the arrest of anyone participating in the plot and sent his military commander, Carlos Howard, of Spanish-Irish heritage, to establish a defensive line at the St. John's River. If the American and French invaders had little more than the enthusiasm of the public, the Spanish were not much better off, with one battalion of infantry, one artillery company, one company of dragoons, and a few sailors. Upon appeals for assistance, Havana sent a company of approximately 187 men. In a last-ditch effort, the Americans attempted to negotiate a treaty with the indigenous tribes to join the invasion, and Mascherie drew up plans for a post-invasion government that held out the possibility of a future end to slavery. But it was not to be. Without naval support to supply the invasion and the withdrawal of the French government from the action, the invasion collapsed. Not all the recruits gave up. Under the leadership of General Elijah Clark, a buffer state on the western side of the Oconee River, the so-called Trans-Oconee Republic, lasted from April to December 1794, but was abandoned under the threat by U.S. military forces. Alderson concludes that the potential invaders were motivated by self-interest and ideology. Land speculation and acquisition of lucrative Indian trade were strong motivators, but many also resisted what they perceived as the increasing influence of the wealthy and powerful in the post-revolutionary republic. In the face of what they viewed as looming tyranny, France appeared as the only protector of liberties and the rights of man. Self-interest and ideology were inextricably linked. In the aftermath of the proposed invasion, the Spanish maintained their control over Florida with difficulty. Mascherie returned to France and, with the fall of the Jacobins, received a pardon for his actions. He remained in the diplomatic corps and was named ambassador to the United States in 1796. The alliance between the ideals of revolutionary France and indigenous settler republicanism remained constant and fueled a critique of the American power structure. and Florida continued to play a central role in borderland disputes until its addition to the United States in 1819.
A fascinating part of Florida history. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Writer and historic preservationist Bob Keeling will discuss the new edition of his book, Kerouac in Florida, Where the Road Ends, on Saturday, January 24th at the Library of Florida History in Cocoa. Sebastian Garcia has more.
Bob Keeling is an award-winning broadcast journalist and author who focuses on Florida history and culture. Bob recently delivered a presentation titled The Road to Kerouac in Orlando, 1995 to 2025. In which he detailed his 30-year journey from researching Jack Kerouac's life in Orlando to leading the efforts to preserve the Orlando home where Kerouac wrote his career-defining 1957 novel, On the Road, and its sequel, Dharma Bums. Bob began his investigative reporting on Kerouac in the mid-1990s, following a paper trail of primary sources that allowed him to locate the exact address of Kerouac's home in Orlando.
It was largely primary sources. When I went to the first house that corresponded with the address of the letter in the Kerouac Book of Letters, it was at 1219 Yates Street in College Park, and there was this sweet older lady here, and I told her about my quest, and she said, well, I hear that he actually lived in an apartment nearby. And I started to realize as I put the pieces of this together, that apartment, that home would be probably very historic because it was about the time of On the Road, but I could never find it. I couldn't find any record of it. And finally, just at a loss, I found the name of Kerouac's, the executor of his estate, who was his brother-in-law. And I looked him up, John Sampas, in the Lowell, Massachusetts phone book, and there he was listed, 2 Stevens Street, Lowell, Massachusetts. And I called him up out of the blue. And he's this wonderful guy, very welcoming, acted as if this kind of thing happened from time to time. And he said, yeah, I got a list of every place Jack ever lived, and it's right here on the wall. So let's see, Orlando, 1957. Yeah, that'd be 14, 18 and a half, Cloyser Street. And that was my first indication of where I needed to go next in the journey.
Once he discovered the home, Bob furthered his investigation to understand what Kerouac experienced and accomplished in that space. Through his extensive reading of more primary sources, Bob recognized that the house held legitimate historical significance.
Kerouac's brother-in-law was also very generous, and he allowed me to travel to New York to the public library, where he had a bunch of his brother-in-law's journals, notebooks, on loan to the Berg collection there. I had this treasure trove of primary source documents, some of them being what he had written when he was living in Orlando from the years 1956 all the way to 62 at different intervals. So yeah, then I really knew I was on to something because I put all of these pieces together and I realized this is the house where he was living when On the Road was published. And that came with this rave review from the New York Times about On the Road, and they called him his generation's Hemingway. And finally, there was validation for him. So now all of a sudden, this little back porch apartment took on much more significance. It represented the transformation of his hard scrabble life and career to that point, to where now someone's finally recognizing him for his talent. So that's when I knew there was historic relevance to the house. And I wrote this 4,000-word article for the Orlando Sentinel talking about my findings, and it sort of picked up momentum from there. Some local residents suggested we try to buy the house and preserve it, and that ended up happening through the generosity of a lot of people.
After securing the necessary funding to restore and preserve the historic home, Bob continued to research Kerouac's life and legacy in Orlando, challenging the popular myth that the iconic novelist came to Florida to die.
I was looking for definitive images of Kerouac in the house while he was writing. He was only 35 back then. And the leading research at that time period sort of brushed off Kerouac's time in Florida as, oh, he went down there to die. And actually nothing could be further from the truth. And his time in Orlando really proved that. I found a review of one of Kerouac's book in a 1958 edition of Time magazine. And in the very corner of the one picture of him they used was the name of the photographer who took it, Fred DeWitt. And I just looked him up in the phone book here in Orlando. So I called him up. I said, yeah, I know you don't know me, but I would just love to ask you about this photo series you took of Jack Kerouac. And he paused and he goes, Jack who? Didn't remember at all. But I was able to go to Time magazine and ask, hey, do you still have the negatives from this photo shoot? And they're like, no, but we do have the contact sheets. Would you like to see them? And they sent me a link. And I'll never forget being at my desk at work and opening it up. And there were these wonderful pictures of him in the house writing. And it's really the only series that actually shows his writing process. So they were just invaluable. So now not only do you have the historic transformation of his career, because even with his own family, he was kind of seen as immature and frivolous. He's in his mid-30s and really hasn't had much success in his personal life or in his professional life. And then all of a sudden, like he said, when On the Road was published over Labor Day of 57, he said everything exploded and he was the new guy on the literary scene. And it's validation. And what's nice for Orlando is this is the only literary landmark of its kind, and it's in the National Register, and it's a Florida Heritage Site. And it also, it's a positive message about believing in yourself and plying in your trade, and hard work's always rewarded, but not always right away.
When I asked Bob to reflect on the most rewarding aspect of his 30-year journey in resuscitating the significance of Kerouac's career in Orlando, he responded with the following.
I do remember thinking what this house would look like as some sort of museum landmark, and I'm so glad that because of many, many people helping make that happen, this is now a place for citizens of Orlando and Central Florida to embrace and cherish, that is part of their culture that predates Walt Disney. And I think the most satisfying thing is to come across these places that are distressed, that are in danger of being knocked down, and publicizing that, bringing that information to the public at large and having people respond to that. I've been lucky enough to have that happen numerous times. I've been the guy to just throw the pebble in the water, but then all the ripples really make the preservation and all this cool stuff happen. I'm glad to be part of the process, but I'm just one link in the chain, but happily so.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Happy New Year. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.